Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Thursday marks the 53rd anniversary of the Clutter murders in Holcomb, Kansas. But even half a century later, people are still studying the book, In Cold Blood, and what author Truman Capote's classic can tell us about Kansas. We'll visit with a KU researcher in just a bit. First up today, what the organization of the Internet can teach us about solving our biggest problems. The key is cooperative thinking and the power of working together. Our guest is Stephen Johnson. He's the author of the new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. He's the author of Everything Bad is Good for You and Where Good Ideas Come From. And Stephen, welcome. So good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be on the show.
How is the organization of the Internet a model for other good things that can happen in our society? Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, well, what we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years is the really unparalleled success of these technology platforms, starting with the Internet, then the web, then things like Wikipedia and other forms of software development, all of which were not developed and were not maintained by the traditional organizations that we kind of take for granted in our society. They weren't built by corporations. Nobody owns the Internet. Nobody owns the web. It's not a kind of private technology. And at the same time, they weren't actually built by governments either. The government funded the early research that led to the Internet. But most of the people who were designing and building the Internet were not working for government agencies. They were working mostly at universities and kind of think tanks all around the world. And they collaborated in this open way, kind of building on each other's ideas, refining each other's ideas, shooting down ideas that weren't that good. And through this process, this kind of what I call in the book a peer network, they were able to build, you know, really a series of innovations that are now, you know, the kind of bedrock of so much of our society.
Yeah.
And so we can, the argument of the book is that that way of organizing things, that would have sounded like some kind of naive utopian fantasy that we would kind of collectively build, you know, something like the Internet without any traditional ownership or without a government telling us what to do. Now we can point to that and say, actually, it's not a fantasy. It's not, you know, we're not talking about a commune somewhere. We're talking about the infrastructure of modern life was built in this way. So what else can that kind of organizational structure do?
Well, and speaking of what else it can do, you really surprised me with an example from this book. It's very early in the book, and you talk about this collaborative approach, very much illustrated by the Miracle on the Hudson event when Sully Sullenberger, who's been here in our studios in the past, landed his plane on the Hudson a few years back. I thought it was just a case of skilled piloting, but you point to a whole different model there that was in play that day.
Right. Well, one of the things that, you know, and I don't want to take anything away from Sully. I mean, it was an amazing achievement that he did. But there are two things that, you know, performed kind of wonderfully on that day. The one was the captain, but the other one was the plane, because the plane, you know, managed to, often as you get hit by that many birds, one of the concerns are that the engines will just explode and bring the, you know, plane down immediately. But they were able to withstand the, you know, in the engines ingesting, you know, whatever it was, 15 birds, something like that, without exploding. They ended up, you know, kind of losing almost all their power, but they didn't immediately doom the plane. And that is in part because every single jet engine, every single model of jet engine that is put on a commercial aircraft is tested extensively for its ability to withstand bird strikes. And they have this thing called a chicken gun, where they take chicken carcasses and they fling them, you know, at high speeds into a spinning jet engine to confirm that it won't just, you know, explode and shatter. And that's, you know, and that's your taxpayer dollars at work, which is pretty. But we never hear about things like that. But the other thing was, and this is maybe the most important thing, the engines had enough power to keep the electronic system going of the plane. They didn't have enough power to keep the plane aloft, but they had enough power to keep the electronic systems going. And the electronic systems included this thing that's kind of casually called fly-by-wire, which is this really fascinating kind of form of autopilot, but it's not an autopilot where the kind of computer is flying the plane. It's a system where the computer is showing the pilot the safe zone for piloting the plane. This, you know, you can't push the plane too far in one direction or another direction. It helps them figure out exactly the right angle of approach and so on. Mm-hmm. And that gave, because that was still running, that gave Sullenberger, you know, a lot of assistance in getting that perfect landing done. So the fly-by-wire system started with NASA, you know, 30 years before, was kind of borrowed and kind of copied by Airbus and put into the Airbus 320, which is basically what Sully was flying.
Right.
And there are thousands, when you think about all the people there, the thousands of kind of engineers and, and you know, brilliant computer programmers and aviation regulators who are involved in that process. And they are absolutely part of the story. But, you know, you can't put 1,000 engineers on the cover of Time magazine, right? And so we don't hear about them. We hear about the hero, but we don't hear about that collaborative network that made that plane possible in the first place.
We're talking about the organization of the Internet and what it can teach us about solving our biggest problems with Stephen Johnson, author of the new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. But the key to the Sullenberger thing is collaboration. And the key to the Internet, you say, is this notion that it's peer developed. What's the advantage to being peer developed, Stephen?
Well, there are a couple of things. The first is an idea that we actually, you know, kind of take for granted when we talk about why markets are good. And this is a kind of an old kind of libertarian argument about markets, which is if you decentralize the decisions in a large group, the overall system gets better. So the old argument about against kind of central planners in planned economies versus free market economies was the economy was too complex for a small group of planners to understand it, right? Mm-hmm. There was kind of this information bottleneck where, all this information in the world had to be condensed down so these 10 planners could understand what was going on, and they inevitably made mistakes because the world was too complicated for 10 people to understand it. Whereas a market takes all that information and distributes it, and all you have to do is focus on your little bit of the economy, just whatever you're buying or whatever you're selling. But as a whole, the market gets smarter. So that's what we've always kind of understood about markets. And peer networks take that and apply that principle in a non-market environment, right? So when you have, you know, thousands of people collaborating, let's say, look at something like Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
You have tens, hundreds of thousands of people who are collectively building the incredible project that is Wikipedia. You know, all those people have to do is, you know, be an expert in their one little field or two little fields or three little fields. They don't have to author the entire encyclopedia. They don't have to know everything. They just have to know a little about something or a lot about one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you have that same principle where you've got lots of people kind of coming together on a problem. As long as they are focused on their kind of piece of it, you can get these great results. But Wikipedia, interestingly, is not a market. It's not a, there's no economic incentive that people are getting from contributing to Wikipedia. You know, and the question is kind of why do they do it, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing that it's been built at all, but it turns out that people are incentivized by things other than economic reward. And there are enough people out there, if you set up the system right and encourage them to contribute with some feedback, some positive feedback, they'll do it.
So, Stephen, when you say that the Internet allows development and solutions from its outer edges, you're talking about who then? Who lives on the outer edges?
Well, in some ways, everybody on the Internet lives on the outer edges. Because the Internet was designed to not have this kind of central core where someone was in charge of it. There was no, kind of president of the Internet. And it we're so used in our society to these hierarchical systems where there's a CEO or there's a president or there's a general, and they are, you know, to use the old George Bush line, they're the decider.
Mm-hmm.
And they make the executive decisions and tell everybody below them what to do. And the Internet is not structured like that. So what people, the phrase that people use is they say the intelligence of the Internet comes from the edges of the network, not from the top or the center or something like that. And that just means that, you know, you look at the success of something like Kickstarter, which is this arts funding service that started 4 years ago for creative people who wanted to get their projects done, whether it's finishing a music CD or putting on a play or an art installation. And they can go to Kickstarter and raise money through, again, a much larger distributed group of potential funders instead of going to a big foundation like the National Endowment for the Arts. They put their project online at Kickstarter, And there's this huge network of people who can contribute $10 or $50 or $100 to support these artists. And again, it's one of those ideas that sounds, you know, lovely in theory, but it'll never really work in practice, except that Kickstarter is now on track this year to give away more money to artists than the entire budget of the National Endowment for the Arts.
And I just about fell off my chair when I read that. Tell us the story about Jacob Krupnik, if I'm saying that right, who he wanted to make this 70-minute-long music video to highlight the process of crowdfunding. Tell us what happened to him.
Yeah, well, this is exactly the kind of thing. You know, this is it's a great story. He was this kind of unknown filmmaker, and he was inspired by this very obscure and borderline, in terms of legality, musician named Girl Talk is kind of his band name, although it's really one guy, who basically just kind of samples other people's music and builds these amazing collages out of other people's music. The New York Times once called this guy an intellectual property lawsuit waiting to happen. And so he barely had a label. Like, he's not on a big label or anything like that. And so this guy, Jacob Krupnik, gets this idea that he wants to make a music video for the entire album. So one continuous 70-minute music video with this woman kind of who is really an amazing dancer dancing kind of through the streets of downtown Manhattan, starting on the Staten Island Ferry. So here you have this incredibly improbable thing. You have a guy with no real background wanting to make a very, very long music video for an artist who barely has a music label and certainly doesn't have a budget for even a normal-length music video. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just a very hard thing to make happen. But he goes on a Kickstarter. He releases a short little, you know, promo video for the idea. He, you know, explains the project. And lo and behold, not only does he get funded, he gets more money than he asked for. And he goes on and makes this video, and by the end of the process, at the end of the year, it won Most Innovative Music Video of the Year from Spin Magazine. That's amazing. Here's a guy who's now, in a sense, had his career kickstarted by the folks who backed him on Kickstarter, and now he can go and, you know, make music videos for people who would pay him the traditional way.
I mean, this is such the antithesis of how we do things in this country. You know, this people have an expectation of a return on their investment. So I'm just wondering, is Kickstarter a fad, Stephen, or do you think it's here to stay?
I think it's here to stay. I think it, you know, it turns out, and there's a lot of interesting economics work on this, most of which I don't really talk about in the book, about how our older model of kind of rational economic behavior, where people are constantly trying to kind of maximize their returns, turns out to not really apply to human beings who are much more complicated and nuanced. In there, it's not like we were all walking around, you know, with little calculators in our heads saying, like, well, this is worth approximately $13.57, so I will not pay a dime more than $14. You know, if you put people in a social context, mm-hmm, where there is some sense of a shared opportunity or some opportunity for collaboration, people are willing to forget about price and forget about traditional kind of economic returns, or at least, you know, kind of bump that down in their priorities because their other values and other kind of needs are satisfying when they interact with other human beings. And by the way, this is why one place where this peer network approach is particularly powerful is the in the space of kind of local communities and neighborhoods, where you have people who know each other and are trying to build a community kind of together. There's great opportunity for people to collaborate in this way, and in fact, there's a whole kind of long section of the book that looks at those in much detail.
Hey, and you wonder if all that would have happened if not for the internet, because it's this side of humanity that is only now sort of being discovered, and it's such a profound side of who we are.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote, after the book came out, right around when it came out a month or two ago, I wrote this article for the New York Times Magazine about the birth of the internet and who had created the internet, because it came up in that kind of notorious speech that the president gave during the summer where he said, "You didn't build that." And one of the things he was saying was, he said, the government built the internet. And I was pointing out the piece that, you know, as I said earlier, the government didn't really build the internet. The government funded some of the early research of the internet, but it was built by these other networks. And the reason why it's worth preserving that story, it seems to me, is that we don't have as a society very many kind of myths or archetypal narratives about mass collaboration, about those thousand engineers that I was referring to in terms of the Miracle on the Hudson. We have great stories about geniuses and heroes and entrepreneurs and the Steve Jobs and Thomas Edisons of the world. But the beautiful thing about the story of the Internet and the web and Wikipedia is that it's a story about all of us, or a huge number of us, coming together to solve a problem or invent something new. And so the Internet, in a way, one of the things I've tried to do in this book is to make it very clear that I'm not just a kind of cyber techno-utopian, right? I don't actually think that the technology is always the solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about, oh, if we could just get everybody on Facebook, the world would be a better place. In fact, it would be probably better if we could spend a little less time on Facebook. But it's more that the technology is a role model, and that we can point to it now and we can say, okay, that worked. Now let's take these tools and these ways of organizing people and put them, you know, off to solve new problems.
Again, our guest, Stephen Johnson, author of Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. We're talking about how the organization of the Internet can help us solve our biggest problems. You know, you're an optimist, Stephen, and it comes through so clearly in these pages. And you build a case and you sort of get at journalism here a little bit, which, of course, is what I do for a living. But this notion that journalism and journalists aren't too often very impressed with incremental progress, when in fact incremental progress is all around us, and you argue we should be celebrating that a whole lot more than we do.
Yeah, I mean, in a funny way, the least interesting news story from the point of view of, you know, a headline writer somewhere is this part of society got better by 1% last year. You know, no one wants to hear that story, right?
Right.
They want to hear the disaster that happened, the plane crash that happened, or they want to hear, they want to hear the great breakthrough, the new iPhone has come out, and it's a miracle, how beautiful it is, or whatever. And for some reason, people are interested in stories of slow and steady decline, you know, that, like, our world is slowly, you know, kind of falling apart. That seems to be a story that people also, that the media likes to run. But the story of things are a little bit better this year than compared to last year, as they were the year before that, that is just something that doesn't get reported very often. And that's a problem because, as you said, that's where most progress comes from. We just get slightly better year after year at certain things. And then you look back after a generation and you realize, oh my gosh, we've made a huge leap forward. And so in the book, I have this little kind of social studies quiz near the beginning where I say, okay, take these, I don't know, there are about 15 metrics of kind of social health, and, you know, what do you think the trend has been for the last 20 years with each of these things? And it's everything from drunk driving rates to violent crime to college dropout rates to, I mean, it's just a really long list of things. And the answer to all of them is that the trend is positive, and in almost every case, the trend it's been improved by more than 20%, in some cases 50, you know, 70% over that 20-year period. And we just don't hear about this because I think in part because I'm not just blaming the media. I think human beings have a bias towards bad news. Our brains want to hear bad news, and we remember bad news better, and we're drawn to it for understandable reasons because our brains, you know, we're seeking out the problem so we can try and solve them. But
and Stephen, how does all this tie back into development of the Internet and working together?
Well, I think that in some ways it's the emphasis on the possibility of progress that's at the beginning of the book is trying to set people up to remind them that it is still possible to be reasonably optimistic. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many conversations I've done about this book since it came out where people were like, our next guest is an optimist. It was like a giant panda. Like, we didn't know they still existed. One of the things that I see from being around the technology sector, so much of what I do, I've written a lot of books about technology. I've started a bunch of internet sites and companies over the years, is that the tech sector people retain this kind of old-fashioned optimism about the future. They think that things are going to get better, in part because they're around technology, and technology is the one part of the American economy where everybody agrees we're doing a great job, and And so there's this kind of infectious optimism that I've always liked in this part of the world. And so I'm trying to kind of take that and set the stage and say, look, there is reason for optimism. And one of those reasons is our new ability to collaborate in these peer network structures.
So what do you think the greatest obstacles are to this collaborative approach that you're championing so much here? What are the hurdles here?
Well, I think there are a few. I mean, it depends really on which part of the sector. One of the things that the book is arguing is that older organizations like governments and corporations can be transformed by this as well. So, you know, I have one whole chapter about how corporations internally can be structured more like peer networks so that they're less hierarchical, that they do a better job of collective decision making inside the organization, and crucially, that they do a better job of kind of collaborating in terms of just sharing the economic rewards. There's a lot of research that shows that corporations that have much better kind of high-low ratios of of compensation, you know, where they only pay their CEOs 20 times what the lowest paid employee gets instead of 400 times, which is what the average U.S. company now does, that those companies that are just basically more peer network in everything that they do actually outperform in terms of the stock market, outperform more traditional hierarchical companies. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why the technology companies out here in Silicon Valley have been so successful is because they've always had more of a peer network structure. They've always been more egalitarian. They always had stock options. They always, resisted the kind of corner office suites and, you know, kind of heavy top-down architecture of a lot of East Coast firms. So in that case, you know, the biggest obstacle is getting people to reform an existing institution like the modern multinational corporation. In other places, it's getting people to, you know, resist the temptation to just dismiss this as so much utopian fantasy. That's why I spent so much time talking about the success of the Internet.
Well, let's talk before you go, Stephen, about one more example of a peer network at work. The maple syrup event sounds lighthearted, but it also sort of leads to this understanding of how a network built to serve the citizens of a major city can actually wind up offering so much more. Tell us about the 311 system in New York City and how it was used to explain the maple syrup event.
Yeah, so it's one of my favorite stories from the book. So, you know, this is what I was saying before, that local neighborhoods, cities, this is a place where peer networks can really work. And with 311 in New York, and it's in a lot of other cities now, but New York one is the most advanced one. This is the service that allows anybody to call in. Instead of dialing 911, they call 311, and they get a live human being on the phone, and they can report problems. There's a pothole on my street, or there's a bar making too much noise, or they can ask questions about city services. And what makes it so powerful is that the city takes in all this information. They've got this kind of real-time dashboard where they can see every call, every request for service, every problem that's emerging, and they tag it all, and they geotag it all so that they can just see where the problems are. And so instead of hiring a ton of people to be on the city's payroll to go around and look for potholes, they basically build this extended network of anybody who can dial three numbers on the phone can be part of this process. And so with the maple syrup event, there's this weird thing where neighborhoods in Manhattan on the west side of Manhattan started just randomly smelling like maple syrup. You know, one morning you'd be walking down Chelsea and all of a sudden the whole neighborhood would smell like maple syrup. And nobody could figure it out. And so they started calling into 911 because they were worried it was a chemical attack from like the Aunt Jemima wing of Al-Qaeda or something like that. And so they call in and the 311 operators are like, well, we don't know what's going on. And so they sent out people to test the air, and it was fine. So they instructed people to not worry about it. But it kept happening. Every couple of months, there would be this maple syrup event as the city started to call them. And it went on for years until finally the city realized, hey, you know, we've got all this data. We know where the calls were coming from. We can use this. All the calls can be clues to help us solve this mystery. And so they looked at all the outbreaks of maple syrup smells, and they looked at the weather conditions, the wind patterns, basically, for each of those days. And when you looked at all that data together, it created this very clear line pointing back across the river to this specific spot in New Jersey. And they drove their van over to this spot where they found this, you know, industrial artificial flavor and taste and scent manufacturing plant that was occasionally making fake maple syrup, like, you know, cheap maple syrup knockoffs. And so it's a beautiful story. Like they it was not a life or death matter. It wasn't a chemical attack, thank God. But, you know, it shows the power of this kind of system, because when they were designing 311, nobody said, you know, we should make sure this software should be, you know, in case there's a syrupy smell enveloping Manhattan, we should make sure that the software can identify it and find its roots, right? That was not part of the spec for the software. But because it was an open peer network that involved all these people, yeah, in the city, was able to solve that problem with great skill. And that's the power of these kinds of systems.
Well, interesting thoughts. Stephen Johnson, again, is the author of the new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. And Stephen, I enjoyed having you. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.